The late and great Pete Shelley was not only one of the finest songwriters of his generation, but also a cultural game changer. His band Buzzcocks took punk out of London and gave it to Manchester and the rest of the world, before creating the DIY ethic crucial to the times. In this in-depth interview, he explains just how he did this.
I just want a lover like any other, what do I get? I only want a friend who stays to the end, what do I get? What do I get? Oh, what do I get? What do I get? Oh, what do I get?
Hello? Hello, is that Pete?
This is.
Hello, it's John Rock.
Hello, John.
Okay, are you alright for a bit of time to talk about punk rock?
Yeah, go on.
Excellent. Well, I'll make it nice and easy. We're just doing chronological order.
Uh-huh.
So, just talk about the kind of music you got into in the first place when you were a kid.
I was born in 55, so when the Beatles happened, that was the start of being interested in music.
Yeah, so the beat was that like a big kind of impact?
Well, it was if you lived up north, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because it was the start of the popular music radio, because before that you just had the BBC Light Service.
Yeah.
So by 6 or 7 when you had Radio 1. And before that there was all the pirate stations. As well, because the Amster came back from Australia, the emigrated and didn't like it. And came back, I think it was probably about 1964.
Yeah.
She came back. And on the way back, she brought me and my brother a little transistor radio each.
Right.
So, I mean, that was my first, with a transistor radio, you had to listen to music, didn't you?
So was that her intention?
Well, I don't know whether it was or not. And then I've got another answer to thank I suppose being interested in music, because I used to go up to a week up 2 weeks holiday, and she's living in Scotland. And so I was out in the country, so I used to go up there. And of course, being in Scotland, near Loch Lomond, of course, it rains, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So on rainy days, she had an old radiogram. And because she was my dad's younger sister, she had, she bought records and still buying records. So she had, like, the Beatles, early singles and things. As well as lots of all the things going back to Lonnie Donegan and stuff like that. So I tend to be a DJ and just sit there playing all these records again and again.
So what point did there? So you got interest there, just sort of what point did pop culture kind of impinge on you more than that?
As the 60s developed, the Beatles became more iconic. It was progressed like that until about 1970. Well, Christmas of 68, I think it was when I first got a record played me on. The first single I bought was Hey Jude.
Right.
But I bought it in October and we didn't get the record set. I just used to take it out of the sleeve and look at it. So there's that thing, the single as being an object.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it was like, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Years ago, yeah, whereas now it's just nothing in it, but then it was like an artifact, wasn't it?
It stirs the groove. Yeah, all that music in there is waiting to get out. So, and the first album I got was Sgt. Pepper, because, at that time, that was the album which everyone received when they went into some house or party.
Yeah.
Then they'd probably have that, Sgt. Pepper, and people were playing it to death. So it's one of those, that's all milestones in music. So I suppose from then I got interested in that side of the music, doing it. Because the album was more of a social event.
Yeah.
Because you only listen to music on your own, you don't have people's houses listening to music. And you don't tend to listen to the same kind of music.
Yeah.
And then in about probably about 1970. Well, in my diary, because my brother used to have an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
And he never played it. For some reason, it was raining on. It was Lee, and it was raining on I can't remember the 4th or the 5th of January.
Right.
I've mentioned this before, but, let's say it was the 4th of January, and it said today I've decided, that today is raining, I've decided to learn to play guitar.
Right.
Because he had a little book, you know, about how to play chords and everything. So I tuned up the guitar because we had a piano which is inherited from my grandma.
And you could tune them straight away?
And I managed to work out what notes and things to tune up the guitar. And started learning to play guitar. I remember at the same time, there was a second-hand record store in Lee, or shop in Lee. And I went in and I managed to get all the Beatles. All the Beatles singles.
Yeah.
Because it was only about like 5p a time, you know, you're paying for the old singles. So with my pocket money and my paper round money, I managed to throw up a collection of them. And then the books you could get were, it would teach you the Beatles hits, but, you know, the easy ways to play them.
Yeah.
You know, having it being complex. So I used to get that and play along with these Beatles songs. And me and a friend at school had the idea of actually having a band. So we used to practice, you know, Beatles songs. So it all progressed like that. So about 1971, I remember that Easter, I think it was. And it was then when Tyrannosaurus Rex, who was my T-Rex,
yeah,
and they released Hot Look. And I went out and actually bought that. And also bought myself a ticket to go and see him at Pre-Trade Hall. And that was 16th of May, 71.
Yeah.
And I went to all that, and that was it. I ended up going back home about the next day and sold all my Beatles singles. and bought the T-Rex one, the one with the 1.5 that gave all these.
Yeah.
And started playing along with that. But because by then I realised that I could actually listen to music and actually work out what records were.
So was glam rock quite an influence on you then? Or just T-Rex?
Well, I mean, I suppose so, because it was what I was saying yesterday, so go back to basics.
Yeah.
The type thing. Because any guitar solo which Mark Wallen was playing was anything that, you know, anybody could learn how to play.
Yeah.
And it was again, full of humour and, you know, and... you know, daring do.
Yeah, they're fantastic, weren't they, T-Rex?
Yeah.
What other bands that period did you get into? Was it mainly T-Rex, or did you...
Well, it started off with T-Rex, and then... Well, I suppose within the year, it was David Bowie, because by May 72, that's when I first heard Starman.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's a great song.
Yeah, it's brilliant, that, isn't it?
And of course then that album became, you know, the one which I would would play and listen to. So I was gravitated towards the more quirky things, which in some ways they tend to shock people.
Yeah.
It tends to be more off the wall type things that happen, but that I would like, you know, rather than, you know, the mainstream and the things which make you seem cool to your friends. I was outrageous. Also remember anyway that time that I saw Alice Cooper on the Old Go Whistle Test.
Yeah.
And it wasn't long after that I went out and bought the Killer album. But that was before he became like mainstream.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like 72, 73 when he did school there, wasn't it? But it was like before that. It was when he was still more punky rather than being, overly theatrical.
Yeah.
And in the same way with Bowie as well. I mean, before he became... I mean, I've heard him, I think it was... Yeah, must have been 72.
Yeah.
When he played in Manchester, just had the John and Molly dancing and then released. So it was before he became, the full chameleon struck butterfly.
Yeah.
Type thing. And he's still, a bit... that edgy, really. Well, it was something which actually did shock.
Yeah.
So I mean, like things like wearing makeup at school, when you're in the sixth form, it's not the normal thing. But it was a good it was a good guise. But to go, so it was like, it was a form of rebellion.
Yeah.
As well as actually conforming to a certain degree.
Yeah, to a different kind of conforming.
Yeah. That's the non-conforming. Yeah.
I mean, did you like all the things about the blurred sexuality of glam rock as well?
Well, I mean, that took me down to a T, because then I didn't have to make any decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I guess growing up in Lee, that's not something that's considered very much.
Mine in a rugby term, so...
Yeah.
You get the pictures. I mean, there weren't many, but they're like Little Britain, being the only gay in the village, but I mean, the only glam in the village.
And did people give you grief, or did they just leave you alone a bit? Or?
Well, no, I mean, some ways I found it actually worked in my favour, that instead of me feeling intimidated, it made other people feel intimidated.
Right. I suppose people respect you for standing up for something, don't they?
Well, no, but it was a bit of a... a bit of a show. I mean, there's a similar kind of thing in Quentin Crisp, where they feel like they're more afraid of you than...
yeah.
You are them, if you have the right attitude to it.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting time in that, especially when you're young and there's so many options to explore.
So you kind of go through the glam rock thing, and then is it a bit of a jump to when you go to Bolton Tech, or is this all about the same kind of thing?
This is just before I went to the Lee Boys Grammar.
Yeah.
So I was listening to sort of a lot of German stuff as well.
Like Cannon, groups like that.
Yeah, Cannon.
Did you get to all those via Bowie? Was he kind of opening the doors here?
Well, there's that. I mean, he was always good at name dropping.
Yeah.
That's how came across the Velvet Underground, a friend of me, but her girlfriend had the Velvet Underground album, because I'd been talking about it to me, and then I made a tape of them. And that's how I got into the whole Velvet Underground thing. And he was another helpful, part of it.
Yeah. So from the Velvet, you get into Cannes and stuff like that?
It's through that. I mean, stuff like Peel, Peel is...
Yeah.
They kind of have sessions on. And I liked it because it was, again, it was off the wall. It was more challenging. It was... it wasn't just, trying to be like status quo.
Yeah. So you're quite a good musician by this point. You've been playing for quite a few years, I guess, now, haven't you? 3 or 4 years.
I won't say I was any better than I am now, but...
But you got to a level where you could write songs. I mean, are you writing songs at this point?
I first started writing songs when I was, I'll be 16. It was about the same time I did male levels.
Yeah.
And during that summer, I was writing lots of stuff. I mean, for the day, it was stuff which I knew that I could actually do once you write your first song, and everything else is a double after that.
Yeah.
So, but by the time, well, I'm about in 73, that's when I actually started getting a band together, which after this their physics experiment, I ended up calling the Jets of Air.
The Jets of Air, yeah.
That sounds like...
very Eno-ish.
Quite futuristic, yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds quite futuristic in some way.
Yeah.
Well, you tried it just for once, found it alright for kicks, but now you find out that it's a habit that sticks. And you're an orgasm addict, you're an orgasm addict, sneaking in the back door with dirty magazines, so your mother wants to know what all the stains on your jeans. And you're an orgasm addict, you're an orgasm addict.
So was the scene very different when you went down to London? Did you feel...
Oh, I mean, it was more passion conscious.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't really a strong sense of what punk style was.
Yeah.
So if you said something that punk, you know, you want to know what, you know, how to suggest what to wear.
So what kind of things were you wearing at the time?
Oh, there's a picture of me for that screen on the green thing, and I've got this pink lab coat.
Yeah.
This Ritz. It looks a bit like a Japanese print T-shirt.
Yeah.
But you know, I think. I think it was like one of those comic book print type things.
Yeah.
So there's lots of big bottles, they're ripped up. I must have been really shocked.
Did you have your sawn in half guitar at this point?
Well, it wasn't sawn in half. That's what Martin McLaren always said, it was sawn in half.
The top sawn off though, wasn't it?
Well, no, the top actually broke up when I threw it across the wall.
I thought it was deliberate.
No. I took it off and I was like, because it was only £18 guitar which I bought.
Yeah.
Which, in those days, you could buy one for Woolworths for £20, but this is £18 in the statement.
Yeah.
It came with a cardboard carrying case as well.
Right, so it's had all the mod cons, yeah.
Yeah. And I thought I was doing a frantic punk inverted cover solo. And I took it off and threw it on the floor. And it skidded on the floor in 2 bits.
Yeah, and you didn't have another £18 to get another one. But yeah,
I picked it up and it still worked. So I thought, oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah, because it looks really good. It's kind of mini iconic punk thing, isn't it?
And it was, you know, this idea that, you know, that it's not about, you know, being able to afford a proper guitar.
Yeah.
Because that's what everybody used to, aspired to, really, if you were a guitarist.
Yeah.
And the idea was to be able to play good and have, you know, the hot thousand. And I just had this, this 50 quid amp and some speakers that got my dad to make for me.
Yeah.
You know, some speaker cap. And that was it. I was aware then. Then we got invited for the second night to the 100 Club.
Yeah.
So that was the night with the Sid Vicious.
Oh, you were there for that one, yeah.
But we've been out again from the tweet.
And right.
We came back from just being holed up into a police van about the Sid Vicious.
Yeah.
So I missed the whole incident. And I've only got the headlines to drug my memory on that.
Yeah. I mean, did you know these people at the time?
No, not really. I mean, the other people we knew was the immediate... Six Pistols entourage.
Yeah.
And the people we used to see in the audience, like Susie and Billy Idol, and
yeah.
Because we remember seeing Susie with a swastika armband and the brown panties on the screen on the green.
Yeah.
Because that was really the first national event called punk.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when. There was this local from Newton, Swansea, Cardiff.
Right.
And he was the one who had the earring and the cheek piercing or nose piercing deal.
Yeah.
And that's chain linking them together.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that was really the first time when people started, you know, were going. And it was also a thing of the checking out the audience. Because
yeah.
it had just started becoming where the audience would become the, you know, the band. So Susie turns up for this gig and, you know, part of the Bromley contingent. And then about a month later, that's the Susie and the Banshees gig, so the night before we played at the Hundred Club.
Yeah.
So it's really, you see the same people, and next week they'd be in the band.
So was at this point now, did you feel like you were part of something, or...?
Yes. I mean, there seems to be more and more of a critical mass building up.
Yeah.
And it wasn't something that you just couldn't, you know, like, ignore and go, oh, well, you know, if I don't do anything, nothing will happen. It was like keeping up with what was going on.
Yeah.
And I think it was, but, I mean, and then after that was when Tony Wilson was doing So It Goes.
Yeah.
And he invited the Sex Pistols up to play. So, I mean, that was, you know, around about that time, you know, there seemed to be more things happening. And then people saw the Sex Pistols on television, you know.
And that's when it just completely went over ground, wasn't it?
Well, it was really the Bill Grundy thing.
Well, I'll say it goes before you keep getting the lineage wrong here, yeah. Yeah.
Once out.
Yeah.
Once the Bill Grundy thing, then it was front page news then.
So how did that affect you? What were you doing?
Well, it was like when Faust became famous, you know, and I was the kid at school and you.
Right, so you were the hip kid, yeah.
and then, you know, people have, you know, that's when people's conception of what punk is, as it comes together.
Yeah, it got formed. Yeah, something different.
Because then people, became confronted with this idea. It was hard to escape it because of Big Four.
Yeah.
I mean, even though when I watched that Bill Grundy thing, because I didn't see it at the time, being in Manchester. But
yes, well, people always forget this. He wasn't actually on outside London, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
And people go on about it like it was a national shock. But, and then these idiot provincials smashing the telly, but nobody outside London actually saw it, did they?
And also, I mean, I don't think anybody watches the ITV local news anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's all it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the way it's portrayed now, it's like it's on the national news or something, isn't it? So, yeah, you said about watching it 2 years later, yeah.
Well, I mean, if you watch it, it really was Bill Grundy's fault. And, you know, John Lydon said, you know, well, rude word, you know. Like,
I'm sorry, yeah, he apologised, he's like a little kid, yeah. He's really unshocking now, isn't it?
Yeah. And also people's reaction to it as well was really odd. But, I mean, in those days, I used to say, you used to stop traffic, you know, by what? About what you were wearing.
Yeah.
Even just wearing non-flared jeans would stop traffic, you know.
Yeah.
It was seen as, I mean, there was a greater degree of conformity than it'd be hard for us to imagine what it was like.
Yeah.
Then, you know, and everybody was walking around looking like, I don't know, I mean...
Yeah, people had like, everyone had long hair, didn't they? If you didn't have your hair over your ears, people thought you were a weirdo, didn't they?
Yeah, that was it. I mean, just have short hair was seen as, you know, a real bold gesture, just the same way that, the 10 years previously, the Beatles once they went up, down to the collar, you know, that was the end of society. If you had shorter than the collar, then it was, seen as being shocking.
It is strange, isn't it, the way people think. So your song, you've already got the song written, are you still writing through this period as well? Or?
Well, by the time we got, the full band, we had about a half an hour set.
Yeah.
That's just grew and grew. Howard did about 12 gigs of us, the 12 gigs in total in the 6 months from 20th of July till the last one he did was for the Anarchy Tour.
Yeah.
It was December in 76.
Yeah.
So it was only a short, you know, space of time.
So what was the reason he left? Why did he leave?
Well, he was in his final year at college.
Right, I mean, it seems weird from the outside because it looks like your band's about to really take off here.
Well, yeah, but you just had to take this and can't play anywhere in Britain.
Yeah.
You've just been swearing on telly.
It seems like a big national excitement. Well, there's some kind of excitement going on here, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, it's exciting, but there is no, you know, there's seemingly no future in it at all.
Yeah.
The authorities are clamping down on it. And so, it didn't really seem like anything was going to happen. And so, I mean, I was in his final year, and his coach tutor said, well, you know, either you spend the next 3 months working and try and get your degree, or that's it, you know, you've stuffed it.
Right, so you got talked out of a rock and roll stardom.
Yeah, well, you know, what's going to happen with this, is there going to be any, you know, whatever. And so I mean, I think he made a sensible choice, really. I mean, it was easy for me because I wasn't doing anything.
Yeah.
To carry on not doing anything and see what happened with it. But for me, the obvious way, there's no fallback position for me.
So when you went back to the rehearsal room after Howard left, was he like, what are we going to do now? Or did you have a pretty clear idea that you were going to take the vocals?
We thought, we get to the end and then they're going to flavour the band, because if he had a finger in,
yeah,
he'd have to be like Howard. Or he'd start stamping his own,
idea. Did you actually consider getting a singer? Yeah. Was there any consideration of anybody, or was it?
We had a couple of calls. There's Rob from the Prefect.
Oh, yeah, I heard it. Did he go up for an audition? Yeah.
Well, I don't know if he went up for an audition or whether or not he just phoned. I can't remember. But he was like, we don't want to get anybody else.
Yeah.
Because, I can think so.
Yeah.
And so then we got Ian Garth that played the bass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Second time in those cards.
Yeah.
And the Steve was a reluctant bass player, only got a bass because his dad tried to, but it fell off the back of a lorry.
Right.
So I've got a guitar here, and Steve looks at it, and it's got four strings.
Is that all? Great. Now. Yeah.
I'm more likely to get a job in a band with four strings than I'm with six, because everybody plays guitar.
Yeah.
And bass players, there's fewer of them.
Yeah. So you got the so now you get the record deal. So when only Archie put out we missed out Spout Scratch, didn't we?
Well, yeah, I mean Spout Scratch is how it swung from as far as the band was concerned.
But you actually recorded more tracks now, didn't you? Because the whole Time's Up album, didn't there?
In October that year that's when we went in to do the Time's Up thing. And we went in on a Saturday afternoon.
Was the plan to actually record the whole lot? Just trying to record everything you had.
Well, no, it was just doing demos so we could hear it. Because, because we didn't have any, mini discs on it. I suppose all we had was a reel-to-reel Jerry recorder of the hairballs and things. So we went into four tracks and we could get an idea about what we sound like.
Yeah.
And so we just went in and just did some demos just so we could see what we sounded like. And then, at that point, you did have an agent. Who ended up being Martin Hammett.
Yeah.
Because he had this music agency called Music Force.
Right.
And he came up with this idea that there was this band who was supposed to be producing. And how... But there's some scam where we get downtime at the studio and we could do it. But it all fell through. But we were left with this idea, you could make your own record, So we found out how much it cost to go in the studio and record. And we found out how much it cost to press and where to get the sleeves done. I'm not sure that information, but we're well thanks to
putting out the record. Was any kind of idea? I mean, why are you putting out yourself? Because you couldn't get a deal, or so? Did you even think about that, or? Or you just didn't know how to get a record deal?
We did. And we thought, well, it's a shame if it all ends tomorrow, if I wouldn't got it there. Yeah. It's a real surreal.
Yeah.
So, it wasn't the idea of taking it. I mean, in some ways it was to have a record, you know, as some kind of document of something that we've done.
Yeah.
But rather than the thinking, you know, it would tell a lot, you know, because I mean, in those days, a single would, you know, could sell hundreds of thousands, you know, a million copies.
Yeah.
So we never thought it would sell that. In fact, we only had 1,000 pressed up. So it's like a limited edition thing. So rather than it being a commercial release, you know, there was no idea, you know, that we could compete with the established record business.
Yeah.
But it was a way that otherwise it was like recording it on a cassette and going in front of those booths where you can record a single.
Yeah.
And doing it like that, you know, putting the your money in the thing and playing pressing play on it. That was the other idea we had. Once you found out you could actually make a record, and then it was such a magical thing, the 7-inch vinyl. And the fact that we made it an EP so we could get 4 tracks.
Yeah.
So that's it wasn't just an A and B side, but it was like a mini album in a way. Or like an EP used to be.
So inadvertently you kind of started off the indie DIY. I mean, I know I've seen it been going on for years in music, but kind of the punk version of it, you kind of kickstarted that by mistake, didn't you?
I mean, that's the thing about ideas. You know, once you give somebody the idea, then they can go and off and do it themselves. You know,
But the record, I mean, it went out pretty quick when you did it, didn't it?
We recorded just after Christmas, and a month later we had 1,000 EPs and 1,000 sleeves. So Howard set up an angle for his lamp on his kitchen table, and we went through them one by one,
sticking them all together.
But taking them out of the paper sleeve, having a look under the light just to make sure that they were perfect, and putting them into the
a labour of love.
Yeah. And we ended up rejecting 2 out of the 1,000.
How many times do you have to repress that?
Well, we did the geometric progression thing, where we started off with 1,000, and then we had 2, turned that into 2,000, and then 4,000, and 8,000, I think, was the thing. I think it was 16,000 altogether.
Which is incredible, isn't it?
15,000, then we... and by then, that gave us the money so we could go on the white right through the smash.
Yeah. And what was that like? Was that pretty amazing?
Well, it was excellent because this was the first time that punk band, it was the first proper punk tour.
Yeah, first one that actually got out on the road and played any gigs, yeah.
I mean, rather than the Anarchy tour, which, had about half a dozen gigs to start off with, and I think we only had about 3 or 4.
Yeah. So it was you, the Prefects, and Subway Sect that tour, was it?
The actual warm up of that tour started when for the first gig that we did without Howard.
Yeah.
And we got asked to play with the Clash at Half and Coliseum.
Oh, that's our first time you played, yeah.
And that was the Clash and the Slits.
Yeah.
Subway Sect, I think, and Buzzcocks.
Ah, right, yeah.
But there was a few gigs where the Prefects played instead of the Slits.
Yeah.
But there was also the other band who was on the bill, who was underneath the Clash and before us, after us, if you know what I mean, was the Jam.
Oh, right, I didn't know. We should get they played that tour, yeah.
Yeah, well, they started off playing it, but then they thought, oh, we don't really want to be associated with them punks.
Right, yeah.
So they pulled out, we then occupy the pole spot. And I think that's when the Slits actually joined the drone as well. I mean, at the bottom of the list.
Yeah. So what was it like that tour? It was always, I always hear a tale of great poverty and stuff.
Well, it was all new and fresh. I mean, you know, it was the first time, you know, I had to go in there and play gig after gig, you know.
Yeah.
Before that, the most we'd ever done was like doing two shows over weekends or something. But this was like, you know, playing, you know, for four or five shows a week. And it was going around, and it was then you got an idea about how big this thing had become.
Yeah. So it's quite about 1,000 a night kind of size venues, is it?
Well, no, I mean, there were lots, in Edinburgh, I think it was a Playhouse, you did. It was Rainbow in London. I think West Brompton Pavilion was one of the places. But, I mean, on the whole, there tended to be, maybe 1,000, 2,000.
Yes, bloody hell. So within a couple of months, it punkered the mushroom to this kind of size, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope it helped with the Clash having sold out. Because there was, you know,
there was
a bit of,
A bit of promotion going on. Yeah.
When people went to see the Clash, they only knew that it was this punk thing. Therefore, people would get dressed up and put safety pins on and spike up their hair and pogo and...
Yeah.
And so it was like, yeah, you know, it was a real thing happening then. It's become more, more legitimised.
Yeah.
And the whole thing just snowballed from there then. I mean, after we did that, I mean, that gave us all national exposure, and we started getting the record companies, you know, buying to sign us.
Yeah.
So we just held out for the one which gave us most control over what we were doing. Because that was another part of the, you know, the punk philosophy was, you know, having control over what you're doing and not just, you know, signing on the dotted line and giving away the artistic, freedoms which are, you know, yours by right.
Yes, you signed at this point now, yeah.
Well,
I'll be signed, yeah. Right. So, is it just UA just looking up for any old punk bands to get their hands on, or...?
Well, no, I mean, they'd already got the Stranglers.
Yeah.
So they'd already accomplished that. No, I mean, we're quite lucky, because, I mean, like, Andrew Lauder is
He's really good, isn't he, Andrew Lauder?
Yeah. I mean, he was the guy responsible for signing Cam, you know.
Yeah, his track record's amazing. Look at the bands he signed up. He's got some really cool stuff, hasn't he?
Yeah. And he was also, he was a facilitator rather than being, you know, like... a suit.
Yeah.
So he made it possible for us to do what we did. So, you know, rather than directing and saying, oh, well, I know better, you know, you need to do it my way or the highway.
Yeah, just left you to it, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he'd say, well, you know, what do you want to do? And we'd say, oh, we'll put out a single. And
yeah.
What single do you want? I said, well, the one which we were thinking of, you know, second thing after Star Scratch is Orgasmatic.
Yeah.
So that guarantees no airplay.
Yeah. And he goes, great.
And but the lady wants us to sleep. Oh, we got this woman she got mers on her nipples and a steam iron as a head. Great, we'll do that then.
So you have actually signed to the right label here, haven't you, because just let you do this. Yeah.
And also the fact that there's Martin Russian who just started producing, he'd been an engineer, but he was actually working there as A&R.
Yeah.
He'd asked Martin, he'd asked Andrew Lauder if he could produce the Stranglers, so he'd just done the recording for the Stranglers.
Yeah, so he's got pretty good...
And we came along, he said, I wouldn't mind having a piece as well.
Yeah. And it sounds great, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, it definitely had that, fairy dust sprinkled on it.
Yeah. Was it engineered by Alan Winstanley as well?
Yeah.
I think he's strengthened. He's done a lot of good stuff over the years, hasn't he?
Yeah.
You can kind of hear all the stuff he does. He managed to make everything sound like very poppy. Very poppy without sounding watered down.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the first Buzzcocks album's a great album. Like, just because it sounds like a punk record, but it's only with its own sound. You think such a narrow constraint of what that sound could be. It's a general variation of it.
Well, I mean, it was an exciting sort of experimental time, because, I mean, like, we thought that Martin had been producing for ages, but really had.
Yeah.
And also, he was fun to work with, and he'd come up with these ideas, and he'd find a way of actually making them happen. So, you know, be like George Martin in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, to go back to the Beatles.
Yeah. So what kind of things are you singing about that album? It's a lot of love songs, which is unusual in punk, but they're kind of the love songs with an edge, aren't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're not about love running smoothly.
Yeah.
That's about the normal angst and things. So, on that album, we had the songs that we've done with, the songs that we've done with Howard, so which, you know, we were part of the set, you know, which I've carried on singing. So things like You Tear Me Up and Love Battery. And,
yeah.
And then there's other things, you know, such as rather German influence, Pulse Beat.
Yeah.
So things like I Don't Mind.
Reality's a dream. A game in which I seem to never find out just what I am. I don't know if I'm an actor or ham, a shaman or sham. But if you don't mind,
what I don't mind about, because that's, on one level, that's very kind of pure kind of love song, isn't it? But that's kind of an undertone to that, isn't it?
Yeah, well it's very, actually thinking that, you know, that they just say that they love you, you know.
Yeah.
The person doesn't really, you know. I mean, it's about the paranoia in love. So in sort of, you know, the darker excesses of the mind.
Yeah. And then these are starting to be hit records, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, from my don't mind, they have to go on to the top of the pop.
Yeah.
To do it, which is a whole new experience.
And you kind of become a pop band, which is like, was that a bit of a shock?
It did become a shock later that year, because I mean, really, I was about 78.
Yeah, yeah.
It really happened a lot, because the album came out in March of 78. And by September, we had Love Bites.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast people worked in those days, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And by then, we'd had about four or five singles a bit out.
Yeah.
And it just really built. So by the time we were doing the Love Bites tour, we were playing, you know, Manchester Apollo all the time.
Yeah.
But five venues all over the country. And then I started again a bit. I don't know, that's when I started freaking out, really.
Well, wow, for what reason?
No, because it just accelerated to the point where, I mean, it's become more pop hysteria rather than, you know, the punk idea.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was only just over, let's see, I mean, it was just over 18 months from doing the White Riot tour.
Yeah.
To be in, you know, the Jackie and Smash It.
Yeah.
And then it became the thing that you'd say things in the press, and you know, and lies appear, you know, things would
change. Yeah.
And they'd try and, you know, all that, you know, that before. There was always an undercurrent of the sincerity, always on to, you know, because the part of it was actually telling it out of the album. That the train it always and pulp me.
Yeah.
And then it became harder to keep in control of that.
Yeah.
As it became more popular and therefore, you know, know, you could sell your papers. And
I mean, did you still feel something of a punk rock kind of... was punk rock still informing what you're doing by now, or is it you kind of wandered off somewhere else? Where would you...
Well, I mean, I suppose so, but I mean, there was nobody actually involved in punk rock. I mean, all the Paul Paisley's about punk rock, you know, this idea that because you become a punk, you're taking about poverty.
Yeah.
But something which came later.
Yeah.
So that more, that more aesthetic side of it.
Yeah.
That was something which, you know, was, all this went to. I don't know if it was a rebellion against what happened. But I mean, everybody was, well, because by then punk had become just a part of the whole new wave thing.
Yeah.
It's still an exciting part of music, you know. But I mean, you know, they tend to be lots of skinny tie bands. Like
yeah, it's never as good, really.
Yeah. Well, it was a different thing in some ways of walking through, but it was an inevitable part of, you know, it's like...
The process, yeah.
I mean, it was true dialecticism in action.
Yeah.
You know, so we started to do, you know, but we'd become the new thesis, you know. You know, which people, every band gets a different way, really.
So,
and then came, you know, the excesses of the drink and the drug.
Yeah, did that kind of help tear the band up a bit, really?
No, it just, I mean, it took everybody.
Yeah.
Unless you got a handle on it.
So you get the third album on the band's past its peak commercially.
Well, I mean, it changed, you see. And, of course, I think, expand. Then all your plans were for this further expansion. And therefore, when things stop happening in the way they expect them to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, but when you come to the difficult third album.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways you don't want to do what you've done before, but in order to maintain the current level of activity, that's precisely what you should be doing.
Yeah. So when you come to those last singles, you are really trying to push the format as far as you can, aren't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're going more and more.
Yeah. I mean, they're a great run of singles, though.
But at the same time, that's when, you know, bands like Madness and the Specials and the old two-tone thing, it started up. And that's really from people who were their first influence in punk has been their first interest in music. And then they've carried on and they're doing other things.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's successful, the people who you owe your success to are extremely fickle.
Yeah.
And they will turn on a sixpence and go off and listen to something else.
Yeah, so it's, yeah.
And there's also things, the bigger you get, the less you do.
Because it gets harder and harder to do.
I mean, the bigger events you do, then the fewer of them you end up doing, fewer gigs. Therefore, I mean, it's always like the momentum progressive. That's the whole thing. It's only when it's like growing as a snowball in effect. You know, getting bigger and bigger. But the moment they stop, it collapses and it's all white, really.
You get out of the band at this point.
Well, this is 1981, so
yeah.
I've skipped quite a few years. But I mean, it was okay when Andrew Lauder left.
Yeah.
Because then we had Tim Chatfield, and he was, you know, interested in music. But
yeah.
When Tim Chatfield left, that was it. It had become Liberty United by then. And then it became part of EMI. And when it became part of EMI, of course the people coming in to deal with it, they're not interested in, you know, in how many records you've sold.
Yeah.
Said, well, how many records you done it for?
Yeah.
And so it became, you know, just like listen to those last three singles and say, well, I don't hear a hit. You know?
Yeah.
And they go, happened. The point is that, you know. So they thought, oh, you know, that you're trying to them to have hits. So. But the funny music is to do something for the thing of doing it.
Yeah.
And for it to be difficult. And not for it to be the same that anybody else can do.
Yeah.
By March 1981, that's when I thought, oh, well. Because I started doing the demos for the Gunstock Sports album.
Yeah.
And
was that just starting to move in a different direction anyway?
Well, I mean, the songs I had were like, I was thinking, oh, well, I could do a version of Homo Sapiens.
Yeah.
So I went to Martin Rush's studio, and he's just got this synth and this programming equipment. So we did a version with that. And after about 12 hours or something working on it, he turns around and he goes, it's finished, this.
Yeah, don't need to stick guitars.
Yeah, a band can redo it. It's no longer a demo. You can sell that. Now that's a good track. So we tried a couple of others. But then played them time to reload it with now A&R at Island Records.
Yeah.
And also the old MD from the United Artists was now at Island Records as the MD. So we played it to them, and they said, oh, I'm Julian. And so we thought, well, this is the way forward.
Yeah.
So yeah. The disintegration of Buzzcocks came this hope that we could actually put together, you know, something in there which was, again, different and challenging.
So you spent some time on the solo thing. I mean, what made you want to reform Buzzcocks? Was only...
Well, I mean, I'd always... Bumping to Steve Diggle, and you know, is there. Well, we should get the band together because, you know, there's all these other bands who are just ripping us off. And,
yeah.
And things like that. I said, yeah, well, I mean, so let them do what they want to, Steve, you know. I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I'd always say, well, okay, I'll reform the band if the band who split up go back together again.
Cause yeah.
That's impossible.
Yeah, yeah. So they call your bluff.
the short of the long story is that in Germany, Steve had been billed as, he was going out of Sagas Convenience.
Yeah.
And suddenly, Steve Diggle, Buzzcock. And then, Sagas Convenience, FRC. And Steve released a single, which was Buzzcock's FRC.
Yeah.
And somebody, there's this young kid from America, he's only about 18, and he was putting bands on in Europe. And there's one of the guys who's going to road crew for him. And he asked him if he was available, and he said, oh no, I'm doing this gig with Buzzcocks. So we got this call from a friend of a friend who said, there's this guy who wants to have a chat with you. So he was passing through London. So he said, okay, we'll have a meet with him. And he said, oh, well, yeah. The band's not together. It's just Steve and it's the FLC thing. I said, well, I mean, do you really think there'd be an interest in there being, a reunion of sorts?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, yeah, I think so. And he said, I'll go and speak to some promoters and agents and things and see whether or not it's possible. So he went to all that, and there's a few things mentioned, but I mean, not a lot. Then our old agent, he got in contact and said, how come you haven't called me? I want to do this show.
Yeah.
I'm not actually back together.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, yeah, we could do this. So he put together, it was like a 3-week tour of America. And so we thought, well, this was, you know, as a possibility. So we found the place, was a bit like, you know, well, you know, the song, I mean, we didn't actually say that everybody had agreed, but then again, we didn't give the impression that nobody knew anything.
Yeah.
And so we said, oh, yeah, yeah, that seems good, yeah, I'm free for those weeks, but yeah, I could do that. So I thought, are we going to work together? So that was in 89. So that was 15 years ago.
So does it surprise you that the longevity of the band?
I suppose so. I mean, I'm pleased about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something which is there in the songs. You know, the songs haven't tarnished and, you know, haven't. I mean, if anything, even more and more people have time to song.
Yeah.
You know, they've achieved that status as being classic.